The following Dharma talk was recorded in March 2013 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of five recordings from the retreat called Dana, Sila, and Bhavana, A Gradual Path of Awakening, taught by Bridget Rollins and John Yaffe. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. The retreat's teachers, Bridget and John, are co-leaders of the St. Louis Insight Meditation Group. More information about them can be found at www.dharmastl.org.
I'd like to offer a few opening reflections just to kind of get us into the spirit and theme of the retreat. And I came across a teacher that I hadn't ever heard of before, in the Thai forest tradition. His name is Bhusim Bhudacharo. And I just found a little quote that I thought was perfect as we're moving into this retreat where we're contemplating the gradual path of awakening and the three pillars of that path, Dana, Sila, and Bhavana. So here's what this teacher says. We bring the virtues of the Buddha to mind in order to take him as an example in our practice. From the moment of his initial resolve, in whatever realm Buddha to be was born into, whenever he performed acts of charity, refrained from unvirtuous actions and speech, or practiced meditation, Buddhahood was always his motivation. Eventually, the power of goodness created by his dana, sila, and bhavana was strong enough for him to become Buddha. Now, in recollecting the Buddha, we take his virtues as our object. So I'd like to unpack this a little bit. We bring the virtues of the Buddha to mind in order to be able to take him as an example in our practice. So the Buddha was not some kind of deity that came to earth. The Buddha was a human being, just like us. You know, his brain had the same kinds of synapses as our brains have. Every thing that the Buddha possessed that was necessary to come to the end of suffering, we also possess. I find this very encouraging. He was just a guy. And he says in one sutta, you know, if it were not possible, and I believe he's saying, if it were not possible to let go of the unwholesome and gravitate towards the wholesome, if this wasn't possible, I wouldn't teach it to you. So he's very encouraging, and I don't know if you ever sometimes have a little bit of discouragement as you practice and thinking, oh my gosh, I'm never going to get there. In fact, tonight, your mind might have been all over the place, or you kept falling asleep, and you think, you know, how am I ever going to do this? Well, you know, the Buddha probably experienced exactly the same thing. In fact, not probably. The Buddha experienced the same thing because he was able to teach about that. From the moment of his initial resolve, in whatever realm the Buddha to be was born into, whenever he performed acts of charity, refrained from unvirtuous actions and speech, or practiced meditation, Buddhahood was always his motivation. So we hear in this, in whatever realm the Buddha to be was born, and the Buddha shared in his teaching that he could recall his many past lives and being born not just into the human realm, but into the animal realm, in other realms. And, but in whatever realm or whatever birth was taking place for him, his heart, his mind was set on Buddhahood, or we might say on awakening. His heart and mind were set on finding the way to the end of suffering. The mind that wakes up, that it awakens to the wisdom, to seeing, aha, clearly, oh my gosh, this is how suffering happens. This is how suffering ceases. So we can see the Buddha cultivated this over many lifetimes. It was a gradual path of awakening. It was a gradual process of purifying his mind from the poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. It was a gradual path of deconditioning that tendency that it just seems that those of us that get born into these cycles of birth, aging, death, and rebirth, that there seems to be this conditioned tendency to grab onto the pleasant and to resist the unpleasant, and we get confused about the whole thing. So those poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion that are the roots of suffering, gradually over many lifetimes, the Buddha, in all of those places, practiced dana, generosity, practiced sila, virtuous action, and practiced bhavana, meditation. Now, I find this also very encouraging. I remember early on in my practice, I kind of took stock of where I was and where I was trying to get to, and I thought, I don't have enough years left to get there. And I would notice a lot of agitation, anxiety, a lot of grasping at getting there, wherever there is. And I remember our teacher, Matt Flickstein, once saying, the desire for enlightenment is an impediment to enlightenment. And his teacher told Bhante Gunaratana, said, don't tell your students that, because they'll get discouraged. No, don't say. And three times he said it to Bhante. On the third time, Bhante G said, you're right. The desire for enlightenment is an impediment to enlightenment. Not that the desire for enlightenment isn't a very skillful desire, but it's more when that desire becomes a grasping at some concept we have about what enlightenment is. Just notice for yourself, and especially when you're comparing where you are with where you think you should be, just notice the suffering that arises from that. I find it very, very helpful to give up on getting enlightened. It's just wonderful. Because I don't have to, you know, be so tense about, you know, not getting the grade at the end of life. And I kind of like this idea of rebirth. You don't have to believe in rebirth for, you know, the practice to really work for you. But it's kind of like, well, my current teacher and mentor, Gloria Tarini Ambrosia, will say, over the months and years of practice, and there's a little part of me that says, I don't want it to, maybe months is okay, but I don't want this to be over the years of practice. You know, I want it, and I want it now. Oh, a little greed coming up there, a little craving attachment. But I find it encouraging that the Buddha, who actually did make it to the end of all suffering, who was liberated completely, all suffering ceased in him. I find it very encouraging that it took him many, many lifetimes to get there. And actually, this becomes for me then a practice of generosity, because it's like, okay, this mind, this mental energy, this consciousness or whatever, has been evolving over many lifetimes in many manifestations, and now I've got it. And you know, I think it's really probably a worthy use of this lifetime to just inch it a little further towards the end of suffering before it passes on to whatever the next being is that it comes to birth in. So Buddhahood was always his motivation. Awakening was always his motivation. And so we can emulate the Buddha, and the fact that we're all here on retreat, you know, unless you're under the delusion that you're going to, you know, pick up a mate for the rest of your life, or, you know, you're here to get guys or gals, probably your intention for being here, your motivation for being here is Buddhahood, is awakening, is to not so much become a Buddha, but rather to continue that process of shedding those things that are covering up your Buddha nature. And the teacher says, eventually, the power of goodness created by his dana, sila, and bhavana, by his generosity, his morality, and his mental development, was strong enough for him to become Buddha. Now, in recollecting the Buddha, we take his virtues as our object. And these three virtues, dana, sila, and bhavana, those are three pillars of practice. And during this retreat, we're inviting you to develop these in yourself. This is an opportunity for you to really focus your attention, like give all of your attention to the cultivation of dana, sila, and bhavana. I find it a bit strange that when I first heard the three pillars, and I found it a bit strange that of all of the heart qualities that we can develop, all of the wholesome, positive heart qualities we can develop, that the Buddha would see the practice of generosity as one of the pillars. You know, I would think that he would put in there something like equanimity or loving kindness or compassion, but it was generosity. And as I've been able to sit at the feet of many wise teachers and hear them expound on this, now it does make perfect sense. Because generosity, dana, can also be translated as giving. And when we give of our possessions, and it might be material possessions, it might be our time, our talent, when we give what we have to do this. We have to let go of it. You know, have you ever given something to someone, you know, and then... Sometimes we do, it's kind of, at least mentally. But in order to give, we have to release. We have to let go. We have to cease to grasp on to what we're giving. And how interesting, that is also how we come to the end of suffering. Because suffering is attachment. Suffering is grasping, clinging to the pleasant things that we want, grasping the unpleasant so we can fight it or get rid of it, push it away. So this letting go of our possessions through acts of generosity is actually building that energy of letting go, which then can translate into that lovely letting go that is at the heart of our practice. Ajahn Chah would say, let go a little and you'll have a little freedom. Let go more and you'll have more freedom. Let go completely and you'll have complete freedom. So the first pillar, the practice of generosity. Second pillar, sila, the practice of morality. And another way we can understand this is the practice of harmlessness. So with when the Buddha talked about morality, wholesome acts, wholesome speech, he was talking about those kinds of speech and actions that refrain from harming oneself and others. Practice those. Refrain from the unwholesome. Refrain from those things that harm oneself, harm others. And this is actually an essential part of our practice, because when we are acting in ways that are unwholesome, that creates a field of harm. So we are harming others. Well, what happens if, you know, most of the time if you hit somebody, what happens? They hit you back. You know, you lie about something. There's all kinds of terrible consequences that come from that. You know, if you're using your sexuality in ways that are manipulative or harmful to another person or yourself, you know, the mind becomes agitated when we're engaged in wrong conduct. And a mind that's agitated and afraid of the consequences of harmful behavior will have a really hard time settling enough to be able to begin to see clearly what's going on, to see clearly what is the cause of suffering, what is the cause of the end of suffering. So our practice of harmlessness or our ethical conduct helps to cultivate a mind that then we can bring to our bhavana, which can be translated as meditation, or even more to the point, mental development. So in the Dhammapada, you know, the Buddha talks about that the mind precedes everything. And a mind that's filled with unwholesomeness experiences suffering. A mind that is filled with wholesome states experiences freedom. So we undertake these meditation practices, you know, everything that we'll be doing on this retreat, we're kind of focusing especially on the mental development part, the pillar of this practice. And all of it is meant to train the mind to be able to see the truth clearly. And when we can really see the truth of what's causing our suffering, we'll be more likely to abandon it and experience a release from suffering. So I invite you to just contemplate for yourself what these pillars of practice might look for you, look like for you during this retreat. A few things come to my mind in terms of generosity. You're already giving yourself the benefit, the gift of this retreat, the gift of your time and energy devoted or motivated towards Buddhahood. Our retreat etiquette, Lucy was telling us, you know, about noble silence, about refraining from interacting with the folks. Now, you might say, well, that's not very generous. I mean, you know, that's kind of antisocial. In a retreat setting, not looking at someone, anybody else, and not talking to anybody else, you know, never making eye contact, is one of the most beautiful, wonderful gifts that you can give to your fellow retreatants. Because we're simplifying the environment. We're simplifying things. Interaction, very important. Bringing loving qualities to interaction, very important. And it does take energy. So we're limiting that kind of interaction so we'll have more energy for focusing the attention within. So if you start feeling uncomfortable about not looking and smiling at everybody, you know, or saying something to someone, just remember, oh, that's right. This is the gift that I give them, is my noble silence. As the retreat goes through, sometimes, we find, irritation arising because someone, is breathing the wrong way, or they're walking in our path, or it might be ourselves. You know, I keep falling asleep. My mind keeps wandering. You know, I didn't get that. I don't understand even what John and Bridget are saying. And we may notice that irritation, and we can give ourselves and each other the benefit of the doubt. If mistakes happen, we can give the gift of patience and understanding and compassion to one another. So ways to practice generosity. The practice of morality, practice of harmlessness. Before we leave tonight, you'll be invited to formally take the five precepts. And these were one of the ways that the Buddha formulated morality: to refrain from harming living creatures, to refrain from taking that which is not given, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from speech that harms, refraining from taking intoxicants that cloud the mind. And I just love the fact that in one of the suttas, the Buddha talks about these as five immeasurable gifts. You know, he didn't say these are five commandments, and if you don't do these, you're going to go to hell. He would say, just note, when you lie, cheat, steal, rape, pillage, murder, whatever, you're probably living in a hell realm. And it's not because some deity put you there. It's simply because that's the consequence of that kind of action. But these are five immeasurable gifts, because when we are engaged in respecting life and respecting property, taking only what we need, being very careful and respectful with our sexual energy, making sure that our speech is kind and true and brings people together and is not frivolous, when we're clear-headed because we're not all drugged up with whatever our favorite drug of choice is, When we are acting in that way, we're creating an environment of harmlessness that we are giving to everyone around us, a sense of safety. You know, if I know that you're not going to talk about me behind my back, you know, if I know you're not going to take my stuff, then I can be at ease around you. And we, in this retreat, we'll be asking everyone to take these precepts so that we can feel free to leave our stuff in the room, and we know that, you know, someone from the retreat isn't going to come in and take it all. We're engaging in noble silence. You're not going to be saying anything, so probably you won't say anything that's harmful. So even the practice of morality becomes a practice of generosity. And the retreat itself is an excellent environment for developing the mental skills, the mental states that open us to freedom from suffering. So as you enter into this retreat, and as the retreat progresses, it would not be surprising if you notice that your mind gets caught in mental qualities that hinder you from being present, from being clear, from being able to really focus and see. You may notice from time to time that you're wanting to have a pleasant experience, especially when we've been sitting for 25 minutes already and it really feels like 45, and Bridget and John must have fallen asleep and forgot to ring the bell. Throughout the weekend, you'll be wanting a pleasant spiritual experience, physical experience, mental experience, emotional experience. There will be unpleasant experiences you're having that you may find yourself hating and just resisting and wishing would stop. You may experience feelings of restlessness and worry, restlessness in the body, worry in the mind. It wouldn't be surprising if you get sleepy. If your mind kind of sinks and gets dull, if your body, you know, you sit down and you notice, oh my God, I am so tired. I didn't know how tired I was until I tried to sit down and meditate. You may experience from time to time, I don't know what I'm doing here. You know, What is this thing? What is this meditation? What is this path? You may experience confusion. I'm not quite sure where to go, what to do. You may experience a lack of confidence in your ability. You know, I just don't think I can do this stuff. You may have doubts about the teaching. You know, it's like, well, I thought Buddhism was a good idea, but now I don't quite know. You may experience any of these things. They're classically called the hindrances. And just kind of know right off the bat that you will probably get caught up in some form of these, either one at a time, or you may have multiple hindrance attacks, 100 times, probably 1,000 times, maybe even 10,000 times between now and when we end the retreat. And please hear me, it's not a problem. When your mind keeps going in all these directions, it's not a problem. You have a practice, and the practice is without judgment and criticism, with kindness and compassion, you just draw the mind back. Jack Kornfield talks about it's like we're training a puppy to sit and stay. And, you know, little puppies don't have the nervous system or the, you know, mental ability to sit and stay for very long. And it takes lots of repetition. So, you know, our minds, even if we've been practicing for a long time, it's like they kind of regress to puppyhood sometimes. And Jack says, the one thing that you don't do is you do not beat the puppy and you don't yell at the puppy. You don't tell the puppy it's a bad puppy and it's a horrible puppy and you wish it had never been born. No. You just say, sweetie, sit, stay. Oh, sit, stay. Oh, honey, sit, stay. I have found it very helpful to speak to myself in those kind ways. So I'm always calling, especially my mind, you know, I'm always, oh, sweetie, oh, little love. Isn't it so cute? Yeah. So I would like to share with you a mantra that I heard from Tarania Ambrosia, and I just love it. So as your mind goes off, please, when you notice that that's happened, now you have two choices. You can get on your case and be discouraged and yell at yourself and beat the puppy, or you can greet it with congratulations as a moment of awakening. You can focus on the fact that you became aware your mind is somewhere else. You can focus on the fact that in this moment, now you're aware and you have the capacity to bring your attention back. So Taraniya said, we might understand our practice like this. Relax, pay attention, be kind. And I love that as a mantra. Relax, I think I'll write it on the chalkboard. Pay attention, be kind. So when you notice that you're all here, out there, or when you notice that you're getting, you know, the shoulders are starting to gravitate up towards the ears, the jaw is clenched, the brow is furrowed, that there's this tension in your body, take a moment to relax. This is samadhi. This is what concentration is meant to help cultivate, a stilling of the mind, but it's also a relaxing, a cooling, a calming in the body. So the relaxing the body can help to foster that calmness of mind. So we relax. We notice any grasping in the mind, that tension of grasping in the mind. And again, as best we can, let go, mentally let go. Tune into your effort. Are you really trying really hard? If you find that you're really trying really hard, there's probably some grasping in there. The kind of effort that we bring is a balanced, enough to be present and interested and enough energy to be there, but without the tensing up of trying to control or hold on, grasp. So relax. Pay attention. So in that moment, the paying attention might be simply to notice what hindrance was my mind just caught in? And treat it simply as an object of awareness. Oh, that's what's arising now. That's what is right now. And then returning your focus to whatever object of meditation we're focusing on. Because throughout the retreat, we'll be taking different aspects of the practice, different aspects of experience, and focusing on them. So relax, pay attention, just bring the attention back, and then be kind. So please, don't beat the puppy. Be kind, be compassionate. You know, when the mind's all over the place, when it's confused, when it's just longing for what it wants, and it's just fretting and fighting what it doesn't like, it's suffering, it's hurting. It doesn't need to get beat up on top of it. It doesn't need to be cursed and denigrated. What it needs is love and compassion for that suffering. You know, our minds, our hearts are just trying their best to find happiness. And as long as we're caught in ignorance, we're going to, you know, it's like the country western song, looking for love in all the wrong places. We're going to be looking for our happiness in all the places where it can't really give us happiness. This practice, this bhavana, this mental development that the Buddha teaches us actually can give us the happiness that we're seeking. So that's just kind of getting us situated in this retreat that we're coming together to support one another in. And there's a tradition in insight meditation retreats at the beginning of the retreat to take the three refuges and the five precepts. And so the refuges are that we go to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha for refuge. And it might be a fruitful contemplation to ask ourselves, when I'm suffering, where do I go for refuge? Is it Buddha, Dharma, Sangha? Or, you know, is it something else? You know, is it the wine, women, song? No. You know, do I look for refuge in just losing myself in pleasant experiences and sense pleasure? Do I run away some way? Do I try to find a refuge in that which really can't give me refuge? So we take refuge in the Buddha, and we can, you know, we can take encouragement from the fact that this human being was able to come to the end of suffering. We can take refuge in awakening. So looking to whatever creates awakening as my refuge, going there. The Dhamma, that's the path, the teachings that are there. So, you know, I could go to, you know, whatever pops up on the browser as far as, you know, buy this, eat this, wear this, change your hair color with this, and then you will be happy. I could go for refuge there, or I could take the path of the Dharma teachings, and listen to that. And taking refuge in the community. Human beings just like us have been embracing this path and finding freedom from suffering, and have been doing that for thousands of years now. And because of their practice, they've kept all of this alive, and it's available to us. So, refuge. And I think I've probably said enough about the precepts and how that creates a beautiful, loving, safe container for us.